This podcast is a member of the Place to Be Nation family. Visit us at placetobenation.com, the only place to be in your pop culture world.
This is It Was a Thing on TV.
Spoiler number one is Dr. Lee Franz. It stinks.
What is going on? What is going on?
Episode 33, Submission 414, The $50,000 Pyramid. Original episodes of The $50,000 Pyramid aired in syndication from January 26th of 1981 to June 5th of 1981, with reruns continuing through September 4th of 1981.
Susan Richardson and Ross Martin. Your host is Dick Clark.
Thank you very much. $50,000 pyramid time on a Friday.
Okay, so if you talk about the pyramid, people love to talk about the $10,000 pyramid. People love to talk about the various intonations of the $25,000 pyramid. People can't stop talking about Michael Strahan for some reason. And there's even a quarter of the interweb where you can go and talk about the few weeks in 1979 where you have the junior partner pyramid with Jimmy Baio as a celebrity.
Jimmy Who doesn't Baio? Love Jimmy Baio? He did soap and I think that's about it.
That's about it. That's well, no, he was in that, he was in that one Bad News Bears movie, but that was it.
By the way, the TV verse, it's a future entry. Just saying.
Yes, it is. So the $50,000 pyramid was, it was wedged between the $20,000 pyramid, which ended in June of 1980, and the new $25,000 pyramid, which was on CBS. That didn't premiere till September of 1982. So this is your pyramid fix in between those two great times. And it was
a fix, all right.
It was very tough to absorb. This is not the pyramid that you loved in the 70s. This is not the pyramid you loved starting in 1982. This was like pyramid turned topsy-turvy on its head.
Yeah, there's a reason why we never talk about this.
Yeah, the game itself is pyramid. Okay, the game itself is pyramid. There's been no changes to it. You still have a little pyramid with the categories, and you give clues, and you've got the winner's circle. And if you go up the winner's circle, you know, doing all the categories and whatnot, you win. So that hasn't changed. But that's like the only thing that hasn't changed.
So what's changed?
Where should we start?
Oh, boy.
We'll start with the fact that in this version, the clock counted upwards, not downwards. It didn't go from 30 seconds down to zero. It went from zero up to 30.
Why?
That's a good question. There is a purpose to it, which I'm going to get to right now. There was actually something called the Player of the Week. And what the Player of the Week was the person who did any round in the preliminary part of the game, not the winner's circle, the fastest, they won generally a trip or a prize of some sort. So whoever had the fastest time in any round in the main game, they were the Player of the Week, the score to beat or the time to beat. And I would guess that counting upwards made determining who was the Player of the Week at that point, the fastest time, made it that much easier because subtracting a number from 30 is so difficult.
Math skills.
Yeah.
Yeah, they're sometimes very tough. I mean, you're talking about two-digit numbers there. That could be very confusing, you know, carrying the one and borrowing the one from the one decimal from the... Yeah, that could be very difficult. Easy for the math teacher to say. But the game played just like Pyramid otherwise, except there were no bonus cards like a 7-Eleven or a Big 7 or Mystery 7 like the other versions of Pyramids had. So you played the main game, you played your six categories. Whoever had the highest score after three rounds went to the winner's circle to play for the big money.
Well, it was
money. It was smaller money in comparison to the 70s version. So you played the winner's circle, but it was for $5,000 the first time you went up there, and a total of $10,000, not $10,000 in addition. The way I read it, and knowing Bob Stewart, this is the way it would be done, your total amount of winnings would be augmented to $10,000. So you'd actually win, you know, whatever, like, yeah, $4,000 more or $4,500 more or $5,000 more. So you didn't really win that as a bonus. Your score was augmented to that total.
Oh.
So why is it called the $50,000 pyramid?
Yeah, why is it called the $50,000 pyramid then?
Well, that's a good question. This sounds like the birth of the $100,000 tournament, which would be used in the later 80s. It wasn't based on how much you won at the winner's circle. Oh, and by the way, there were no returning champions. So you played your show, your two halves of the show, you're gone. They bring on two new players. So there's a one downer right there. You're on for only one show, and then you're gone, and you're playing with these convoluted rules. But so what they did, it wasn't based on who climbed the winner's circle pyramid fastest, like in the 80s version. No. What happened was the eight past players of the week competed over the course of a week. So it wasn't based on how high you went on the pyramid or how fast you went at the pyramid. No, it was based on, did you have the fastest time in one round of the main game?
Whoever had the fastest time in the main game, win or lose, that is your, quote, player of the week.
And that's your tournament player. So this could be a person who had one really lucky round, got it done in 18 seconds, and could have blown everything else in their episode. They could be in this tournament with absolutely zero money, nothing to their name, but they're playing for $50,000 because they were the fastest player in a round in that week.
That's terrible.
That's terrible on top of terrible.
Wait until you hear how the tournament was played. Oh. This is, again, complex and terrible. So you had eight players in the tournament on Monday and Tuesday of that week. You had four players playing each day. You had players 1, 2, 3, 4, let's say, in the Monday game, players 5, 6, 7, 8 in day two. So each player only played one half of a show. And the winner of each of those games would go to a semifinal game that would be played on Wednesday and Thursday. But also, you only played the pyramid for $5,000 at this point. So you could win $5,000, but again, you could get skunked or win only a couple hundred dollars. But you're advancing to the Wednesday and Thursday show where the two semifinalists each played two games against each other. So you have the, like, for example, let's say the winner of Game 1 and Game 2 versus the winner of Game 7 and Game 8, they would play the Wednesday episode, and then the other two people would play the Thursday episode to figure out who would come back and play for the $50,000 proper. And again, the winner's circle is worth $5,000 for the first try, $10,000 for the second try, just like the regular gameplay. But now here's where it gets crazy. We talked about the Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday, Thursday episodes. What are we doing on Friday?
What are we doing Friday?
That's a great question. The losing contestants from the semifinal games played in a wild card match. So if you were a loser on Wednesday or Thursday, you came back Friday, to earn a spot for the next week for the $50,000 tournament. You're going to need like a roadmap for this, I think.
Yeah.
So they play. So the Wednesday loser played the Thursday loser on Friday, and whoever won that day by getting the most money would join the two winners from Wednesday and Thursday playing for $50,000. And the way this happened, you had the two finalists playing in the first half of the show, and if the winner's circle wasn't won, then the loser of game one would sit out, and that third player would come in and play the second half of the game.
Okay, and now it's kind of starting to make sense.
This is starting. It's you can see how it's sort of
I'm seeing
turning into the. You can see how it's turning into
the blob is starting to form like a crystalline prism shape. Another math term that Mike would get, but nobody else would.
Well, you can see how this is sort of like the genesis of the $100,000 pyramid tournament.
Yeah.
Yeah, so there's the basis of that tournament here, but and again, if you win the winner's circle starting on that second Monday, you win the $50,000. Tournament's done, but if not, the loser in that first game got replaced by the third player.
So this kept going until there was a winner.
Yeah, this kept going until there was a winner. So if you had players 1 and 2 in game 1, let's say player 1 won, player 3 would replace player 2 in the second half of the game, and whoever won that, as long as they didn't get to the winner's circle, they would stick around for the first game on the next episode, and the person who sat out the second game would go in. Yeah, so you'd have basically these three people rotating in and out.
Until somebody won something.
And the thing is, everybody plays at least once a day, which is good. But also at the same time, if you got somebody who's killing it in the main game, you could have player one versus player two in the first half of the game, then player one versus player three in the second half, and then repeat that over and over again. If player one is like really great at the main game, but totally sucks at the winner's circle. So yeah, win the winner's circle, you get the $50,000, yay, tournament's done. And given how long this show ran, looks like they did maybe two, maybe three tournaments at most.
I think they did three.
Sounds like they would have done three, yeah.
Well, if you look at it, we said January 26th of 81 to June 5th of 81. So that would be about 4.5 months. So let's say that's about, no, that'd be like about 18 weeks or so. Well, maybe a little bit longer, maybe 20 weeks. They may have only done two tournaments.
Mm.
Because think about it. You have to get the eight winners of the week. And then let's say each tournament week ran 2 weeks. That's 10 weeks. Double it would be 20. And that would be just about the length that the $50,000 pyramid ran.
Okay. Then the math works out then, so.
It does, yes. Okay. Well, there's not much you can talk about Pyramid outside of those stupid changes.
Yeah, we can't even find a list of people who are actually on the show, which is weird.
No, wait. Chris hold Lane on his old site probably does.
Yeah, hold on.
Let me go.
Oh, my God, are we doing a postscript?
Yeah, we might be doing a postscript.
Hold
okay,
up.
Here we go. So there were 19 weeks of shows. That tells me two tournaments. And we've got, just going down the list here, Dee Dee Cunn and Brian Patrick Clark, Shelly Smith and Nipsey Russell, Anita Gillette and Soupy Sales, Joanne Worley and Sal Viscuso, Rita Moreno and Jay Johnson, Adrian Barbeau and LeVar Burton, Ann Mira and John Gabriel, Elaine Joyce and Tony Randall. Then for your tournament, it looks like Joanne Worley and Fred Grandy, Joanne Worley and Soupy Sales. Then let's see here. Then you've got Joanna Gleason, Robert Mandan, Susan Richardson, Ross Martin, Dee Dee Cunn, Robert Mandan, Donna Mills and Ken Kercheval, Constance McCashin and Greg Morris, Lois Nettleton and LeVar Burton, Dee Dee Khan, Nipsey Russell. Then looks like the last 2 weeks, which probably constitute the entire tournament, is Anita Gillette and Grant Goodeve.
So you're basically looking at the usual pyramid suspects.
To an extent. I don't know how often that some of these people played pyramid in the 70s. LeVar Burton, I don't know if he did. I know he did in the 80s, obviously, but...
Obviously, in the 80s, but in the 70s, he would just be coming up thanks to Roots on ABC.
Yeah, he's probably living high on the popularity of Roots, so he probably didn't do Pyramid back then. But you see Elaine Joyce, Tony Randall, Joanne Worley, Fred Grandy. I don't know how much, again, he did in Pyramid in the 70s, but he obviously did some of it in the 80s. Robert Mandan, definitely. You know, I'm actually looking at this. I see a big commonality here. What is all the? Were you going to say it?
I was about to say that's a lot of ABC talent.
Not just ABC. Yeah. Not just ABC. A lot of soap. Sal Viscuso, Jay Johnson, Robert Mandan. I mean, that's only three celebrities, but that's a lot of soap right there. And that's not counting Billy Crystal, even though he didn't do this version.
And if you want to be technical, you could count Dee Dee Khan in there because she was on Benson.
She wouldn't be on Benson
for another couple of years or so.
But she was on Benson.
She was on Benson by 81.
She was soap adjacent, let's say.
Yeah.
But then, yeah, Susan Richardson, I think, may have done Pyramid in the 70s, the $20,000 version. Pretty sure she didn't do it in the $25,000 version in the 80s. Ross Martin, I'm sure, definitely did. Ken Kercheval, I know, did the $25,000 Pyramid, the CBS version. Constance McCashin, I know, did the CBS version. Lois Nettleton did like every version of Pyramid, so that does go. So that goes without saying. Nipsey Russell did it, obviously. Nipsey Russell, that's all we need to say. And Anita Gillette, that's all we need to say right there. Those are people who played like every Pyramid.
And correct me if I'm wrong, wasn't Constance McCashin a contestant on Pyramid before she was a celebrity?
I believe she was.
I think she was, yeah.
Constance McCashin was seen on the $20,000 pyramid as a contestant.
$20,000.
So she was a
$20,000.
Yeah, that makes a lot more sense than what Wiki says, which is why we can't exactly trust Wiki. So yeah, she was
truth
on
by consensus. Yes.
Faulty truth by consensus. Wikipedia is wrong. So yes, Constance McCashin was on during the $20,000 era back in the 70s.
All right, then.
So, taking a look at the celebrities, like everybody had experience on the 70s version, though a couple people sort of cut their teeth on this version. Like I said, I don't think LeVar Burton was on the 70s version. Joanna Gleason, I don't think she ever did Pyramid either before or after, because I'm just thinking that maybe she was somehow bound to NBC, so she did Password Plus instead, because she's been on a number of weeks, including the Hello Larry week.
And she was on the final week of Chain Reaction.
She was on the final week of Chain Reaction 2, right. So, yeah, I just wonder, yeah, if, yeah, Joanna Gleason must, I don't think she's done either version. This might be the only version she did. Plus, also, I know at least in this area, the $50,000 Pyramid aired along with, I don't know if it was before or after, Let's Make a Deal, the Canadian version. So,
that would actually make sense, because Let's Make a Deal was actually running concurrent in that time period.
More or less, yes. Tony Randall did all that. I know Jay Johnson was on the ABC version, and he did $25,000 Pyramid. Rita Moreno's done it all.
She's on the Strahan version recently.
That's what I was just going to say. She's been on the Strahan version. So she's done literally like every version outside of maybe the GSN version from like 8 years ago. Shelley Smith. I don't know if Shelley Smith was on the ABC version, the $20,000 Pyramid, but she sure as heck was on the $25,000 version on CBS. You truly have a lot of Pyramid players here. Great Pyramid players at that. I mean, the only names that don't really ring a bell for being Pyramid players are John Gabriel. And I don't remember Brian Patrick Clark playing much Pyramid. I mean, he was definitely a thing. He did game shows. He did Match Game and Match Game PM back in the 80s. Actually, I think he was the winning answer on Match Game PM where Jack Klugman went all goofy, where he spun the wheel and knocked down. Yeah, he was the super match celebrity there.
Oh.
Donna Mills. Did Donna Mills do much Pyramid? I don't think so.
I don't think so.
And Susan Richardson, we said already, yeah.
Well, I would think because Knots Landing was CBS, wasn't it?
Yeah, Knots Landing was CBS, and it would have just been starting.
Yeah, because, no, well, Knots Landing started in 79, so it would have been on for a good 2 years at this point.
Well, also, she's But also, she was on The Week with Ken Kercheval, who was on Dallas. So that makes sense. At least you got the original show and the spinoff, if you will.
That's true.
Okay.
Greg Morris, was Greg Morris on Pyramid back in the
day? I don't know if he was ever on Pyramid, but I do know he did make the rounds when he was doing Mission Impossible.
Oh, yeah. He definitely was on
him and his son. Him and his son were both on Match Game.
Yes, they were. But yeah, he also, Greg Morris, he did Password Plus. He did a lot of Password Plus. He was on Match Game, obviously. I thought you might bring up Jackie Childs since you're talking about Greg Morris' son.
Oh, I would have loved, yeah, I would have loved to have brought that up. Seeing I bring up Matt McCoy's Lloyd Braun all the time.
IMDb is saying this, and I trust IMDb more than I do Wikipedia. It's showing that the only week of Pyramid that Greg Morris did was this week.
Okay.
But yeah, he did Match Game PM, he did Match Game 73, Tattletales, Crosswits, Celebrity Bowling, Stumpers. Oh, there's another. Hey! Oh, no, we added Stumpers to the list. Okay. Break the Bank in 76, Hollywood Squares, Show Offs. You Don't Say, both the 75 version and the original version back in the 60s. All-Star Baffle, It's Your Bet. So he's done plenty of shows. But yeah, this is the only week of Pyramid he ever did. Never did 10,000 or 20,000, never did 25,000, but he did the $50,000 Pyramid. Interesting, but also, again, the number of times he did Password Plus, it's not surprising he'd be doing something like Pyramid, which is similar but different to Password Plus.
Okay.
So now we have formal closure. We've talked about the celebrities, but there's more. There's more, isn't there, Greg?
Yes, Mike, because, in fact, this, as we teased in the Bill Cullen Centennial, this was the last version of Pyramid, at least until the recent Michael Strahan version of the $100,000 Pyramid that taped in New York City.
The end of an era of sorts.
Yeah,
and an end of an era for the game shows going back to the 50s, taping primarily in New York.
And now the show's done. Richard Bay was a contestant?
What?
Richard Bay?
As in
the running gag of Talk Soup back in the day?
As in him. IMDb says he was a contestant in 1974. But thankfully, this this abomination, and I say that the nicest way possible, this abomination lasted 4.5 months, went on hiatus, yeah, we'll say hiatus, for about a year, and then came back to CBS daytime, and the rest is history.
Yeah.
And it really is, yes. And again, this is the redheaded stepchild of Pyramid nobody wants to talk about, or nobody really does talk about, but you know what? We talk about it. And do you know why we talk about it?
Because while you have the $10,000 version, any version with Dick Clark is classic. And even Donny Osmond and Mike Richards had some redeeming moments. And John Davidson, too. And Michael Strahan's Pyramid is a classic of the making. But the $50,000 Pyramid from 1981... Oy. It was just a thing on TV.
Promotional consideration paid for by the following.
Place to be Nation's JT Rosero and Chad Campbell here. We want to let you know that we have over 24 podcasts available on iTunes, Stitcher, Google Play, and PlaceToBeNation.com. We now offer them to you on two great feeds. On the Place to be Nation wrestling feed, we dive into topics running the gamut from today's WWE to the glory days of yesteryear and the ins and outs of the territory days. In addition to our full-length shows, we also deliver to you special pod blasts on topics old and new.
The Place to be Nation pop feed is a veritable treasure trove of great content. Offer tremendous shows covering the land of movies, television, life, comics, and sports, brought to you by the most knowledgeable and insightful folks in the podcast world.
You can find all these great shows, plus archives of our past podcasts from over the past 8 years as well by subscribing to both feeds on iTunes. And while you're there, be sure to rate and leave feedback as well. All of these shows, plus others, available on PlaceToBeNation.com, where we cover pro wrestling, sports, movies, comics, plus in-depth search projects, and much more. Be sure to support our site by using www.PlaceToBeNation.com/Amazon when doing your online shopping. We want to thank our friends at Boneheads, Wing Bar, ProWrestlingOnly.com, and TheHistoryOfWrestling.com as well. Be sure to follow us on Facebook, Twitter, Instagram, and Tumblr. PlaceToBeNation.com, the only place to be in your pop culture world.
Episode 34, Submission 014, It's Your Move. It's Your Move originally aired on NBC from September 26, 1984 to February 23, 1985, for a total of 18 episodes. And David Garrison is Norman.
And then there's that last note, which sounds like it's off. And David Garrison is Norman, yes.
Because, honestly, David Garrison makes anything good.
Yes.
What else has David Garrison done besides this and Married with Children?
That's exactly my point.
He's 2 for 2. Two great shows. That's all he's done. He said, you know what? Two's enough.
Two's enough for me.
I'll stop while I'm hot.
Okay.
Well, no, because he also, you know, he went back to Broadway and did a lot of
Broadway. He did. Yeah, and that made every Broadway show better. It's Your Move. I gotta say, of all the short-lived television shows, I'm very surprised that this show, from our research, is so fondly remembered to this day.
Well, it was one of those shows that was the precursor for the teenage shenanigan razor, so to speak. I mean, your Zach Morris was born out of your Matthew Burton, who, by the way, is the character played by Jason Bateman on this show.
Now, you see, I actually disagree with Chico. I think Matthew Burton was sort of a predecessor, a raw version of Bud Bundy.
Yeah, I can see it, especially considering this show was created by Ron Levitt and Michael Moy, the creators of Married with Children.
Right. Yes.
And the thing of it is, and I believe you have the clip from the, I believe, the American Television Archives. This was just another entry into the Michael Moy sort of pantheon that has one rule and one rule only. Kids are smart, adults are dumb.
It's your move. If you remember, and this, again, reflecting the times, ironically, you know, we tried, because of the times, what we tried to do was come up with a show, come up with a premise that really, we really wanted to do the opposite of what was popular. That's another thing that I'm known for. When the world marches in this direction, instinctively I go in this direction. At this point, a lot of the, you know, the Lear type morality plays, you know, were, that was over, that era was over. And we were all surfing the crest of the wave of Cosby. And all of the shows, and I didn't have a problem with Cosby. I think there's a, you know, there's an idea out there that I did not like Bill Cosby, which the Bill Cosby show, which is actually not true. What I did not like were shows that were trying to be the Bill Cosby show. And as you know, television being somewhat imitative at the time, they weren't hearing anything but networks, but shows that were like the Bill Cosby show, because that's what everyone wanted. They wanted a hit like Bill Cosby. We in development then, you know, knew what we had to do was try to do a show that was sort of unlike Bill Cosby. You will hear this again when it comes to It's Your Move. I mean, Married with Children. And so what we wanted to do, so we tried to develop a show where the child in the show, where the kid in the show was, had their parents basically wrapped around their finger. This wasn't going to be a show like Cosby where, you know, the parents, of course, know everything, that the kids may try to fool them, but in the end, you know, the parents know, and we got you. Don't you know what, one time we were your age? And, you know, every once in a while you'll run into a kid who is actually, you know, a born con man and really can pull the wool over, you know, their parents' eyes. We wanted to do a show about that kid. And we remember from Silver Spoons a kid named Jason Bateman, you know, from Silver Spoons, who we thought had that natural ability, you know, he could play that character, he could be that guy. And so we did a show about a kid who basically ran his high school not through thuggery, but by the fact that he actually was pretty much a genius. He might not have been a genius with all A's, but I mean, clearly this kid was going to be a politician. Clearly this kid, when he grew up, was going to be a senator. Because by the time he was done manipulating, you know, and having kids work for him, you know, he could do whatever he wanted. I mean, yeah, he could have all A's. He could also have his principal's driver's license suspended. I mean, he could do things. I mean, he could just sit back in his chair, from his chair, and basically be the godfather without any guns, without any threats, without any blood. He was that kid. And that was sort of the seed of It's Your Move. And we gave him, you know, a mother that he doted over, you know, a single mom, you know, that he would dote over and protect. And she need, because she did need that in his mind. The hook was that the guy that moved across the hall from his mother was an adult version of what that kid used to be. You know, he has the same kind, he had that same kind of mind. And also, you know, and liked his mom, you know, and wanted a relationship with his mom, which was just what made the kid crazy. You know, and it was just sort of a battle of wits between, you know, a 12-year-old and, you know, and a 30-year-old, you know, over the affections of mom and their basic abuse of each other, you know. It was a very tough show to write because we had to constantly have these guys, you know, try to outwit each other. So it was one of these where you almost would write backwards. You know, we write from the resolution, you know, who won that week, and then say, you know, write it backwards. Up to that point, it was, you know, my favorite show that I had ever done. You know, a lot more work went into it than normally because a lot of the story twists and turns were a lot more complex. But it was, you know, it was my favorite. During the casting of that show, by the way, is when we first ran into David Garrison, who was phenomenal. You know, he played the love interest. He played the, quote, you know, a grown-up con man across the hall.
Just so happens that Norman, played by David Garrison, is a 14-year-old trapped in a 40-year-old's body because he too is smart. And you have the endless game of cat and mouse between Matthew and Norman. And it gets better. It really does, because Norman is dating Matt's mom, played by the ever-so-talented Karen Kay.
And that's really how we got the name It's Your Move, because whatever Matthew does...
Whatever
plot Matthew has, Norman has, like, the perfect solution to outdo him or take him to the next level. But then also at the same time, it's like whatever Norman does, Matthew outdoes him. So it's always somebody's move. But one thing I want to mention, guys, did you ever notice about the opening sequence? The show's called It's Your Move. Did you ever notice the background is a checkerboard?
Yes.
It's Your Move?
Yes.
It's checkers. I think there's a hidden meaning in there.
A little bit.
I never realized that until you brought it up, yes.
And this has been another Mike Klaus's mind blower.
But this was like the first big starring role for Jason Bateman, because he had been the friend to Ricky Schroeder's character for two seasons on Silver Spoons.
Yes, he has. And actually, interesting you mentioned that. Thanks to our good friends at 13 Week Theater. It's Your Move actually began life as a Silver Spoon spinoff. Or a applauded Silver Spoon spinoff. Because Jason Bateman, who played Derek on Silver Spoons, his parents go through a divorce, and they were going to move away. Turns out their life was going to be the subject of this show. And Jason was on board, NBC was on board, but here's the thing. The writers, Michael Moy and Ron Levitt, they did not own the Derek character, and they did not have the rights to use the Derek character. What's a writer to do?
Yeah, and the thing is, I don't know if I would call Jason Bateman's character on Silver Spoons a friend of Ricky Schroeder's. He was a bit of a jerk.
I believe the term you're looking for is frenemy.
I don't think we used that term back in the early 80s, but you're absolutely right about that.
So we have Matthew Burton, his mom Eileen, played by Karen Kay, his sister Julie, played by Trisha Cast, and rounding out the cast is Lou Donatelli, played by Ernie Sabella. This was before Perfect Strangers and or The Lion King. And a guy named Eli, played by Adam Sadowski,
who would later go on to a show called Boys Will Be Boys, but Greg knows it better as future installment that he can't wait to do, Second Chance. So what happened is you had Norman. He moved into the apartment complex, actually across the hall from Matthew and his family. So he started hitting on Eileen, Matthew's mother, thanks to a scheme created again by Matthew. Norman moves into the apartment and he sees a loose floorboard or piece of wood, and he wants to get that fixed. Well, coincidentally, at the time, who was Eileen dating? She was dating like the wood king of Southern California. So he came and fixed it, and guess what Matthew did? He nailed that person into the apartment, and he was stuck in there.
Whoops.
And then at the same time, well, David Garrison's character, Norman, can't get in the apartment. So what does he do? He goes to his next door neighbor's apartment where, oh, coincidentally, Matthew is, but also there's Eileen. And they sort of hit it off again with mingling by Matthew. And we never hear from the Wood King of Southern California ever again, the Wood Flooring King.
Aww.
Well, he's probably stuck. No, he didn't get stuck in the apartment. They eventually let him out. But yeah, that was the pilot episode. We had the Wood Flooring King of Southern California fixing Norman's apartment, and he got screwed. Literally, he got the doors.
I thought he got nailed.
Screwed, nailed. Hey, they're both good double entendres. That was the pilot.
Episode 2.
Put to the test. Matt's successful business selling answer keys to classmates is thrown for a curve when Norman is hired as a substitute teacher. So not only is Matt's mom going out with Norman, Norman is now Matt's teacher. It's his worst nightmare come to life. Twice.
Also, calling back to the pilot, one of the key parts of the pilot at the end had to do with spelling done by Matthew and Eli. And that just makes me wonder, would you really want to get answers to a test from somebody who couldn't spell a word correctly? And the word was special. And he forgot the letter I. He had S-P-E-C-A-L, not S-P-E-C-I-A-L. He had Spiegel. Yes. So do you really want answers for a test from somebody who can't spell the word special, especially when he's 14 years old, presumably in eighth or ninth grade? I don't think so.
No.
No. Something wrong about that.
Episode 3, Dating Games. In a rare righteous moment, Matt chooses his friend Eli of a date with Julie to the Harvest Ball. Julie has no intentions of dating this lower life form, which forces Matt into his bag of tricks to save face.
Harvest balls in Southern California?
What do they harvest in Southern? That's more of a Central Coast thing.
Well, I was going to say, that's more like a Midwest / Plains thing. Maybe they're harvesting sand or smog. I don't know.
Should ask friend Jason Reyes, hey, have you ever been to a harvest ball in Southern California?
Yeah, what do you harvest down there? Plus, also, I've never heard of really a harvest ball. Now, I don't live in a rural area, but I've never heard that term used. So I wonder if that died, like, in 1984, thanks to It's Your Move.
Yeah. Thanks, Matthew Burton. You killed Harvest Balls.
Aww.
Balls! Balls. Yeah, balls!
Balls.
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 In your
In
pants.
Your pants.
Episode 4, Nightwork. For the first time in his young life, con artist Matt meets resistance to his devious courting strategies when they are complicated by some clever monkey business from his neighbor Norman.
Oh, well, he found his match.
Yeah.
If you've seen the pilot episode, he truly has found his match because there's a lot of scheming going on between the two of them, which really doesn't come apparent until the last minute or two of the show.
So, yeah, it's sort of a, again, your classic cat and mouse. Like, all right, yeah, you see what, I see what you're doing. Hey, guess what, Matt? I got you. And then Matt's like, yeah, I see what you're doing, Norman. I got you.
Oh, but just wait for episode 5. Pajama party. Matt and Eli planned their greatest conspiracy, bugging Julie's pajama party.
Oh, yeah, that's wonderful. Bugging your sister's pajama party.
There's more to that pajama party, because party plans are ruined after Julie hijacks the apartment, and realizing the revenge potential of Julie's slam book, you people who've ever seen Mean Girls, it's called a burn book now, he schemes to discover its hiding place.
Eli is sort of like Matt's henchman.
Yes.
Not too bright, though. He doesn't come across as terribly bright. But yeah, he's like Matt's assistant.
Yeah.
He's like the Waylon Smithers to Matthew's Mr. Birds.
I was thinking more like Otis Graves to Matt's Lex Luthor.
Oh, I had even a better one. I thought that Eli was more like the General Disarray to Matthew's Professor Chaos. The South Park reference, if you don't get it.
All right. So, as we move on to episode number 6, Love Letters. Ooh. Romance may be slipping through Matt and Norman's fingers as a web of suspicion surrounds love letters each receives from a supposed secret admirer.
Yeah, that can't go wrong.
This will totally work. Totally work. There's absolutely nothing wrong with this plan. Nothing at all. Not a single thing.
It seems like this show should actually be called Can You Top This? I know that was Taken, but...
Just a little bit, yeah.
Yeah, well, just a little bit Taken, but the thing is, again, it just seems like every episode, one is trying to outdo the other, who's trying to outdo the other, and it just goes back and forth. And again, like I said, that's apparent on the pilot episode where Norman received letters from publishers in New York City saying, we'd like to have you work for, I think it was the New Yorker or the New York Times. And it turned out to be fake. And then he received another letter from, I forget, some other publication saying, oh, we'd like to, you know, we like your story. We want to run this story. It was like Atlantic Monthly or something. The problem is, and this is a callback to what I mentioned earlier, Norman could tell that Matt set him up because guess what? I mentioned this just a few moments ago. Matt misspelled the word special in the letter.
Oh.
S-P-E-C-A-L. You got caught, Matt. Nice try. There's no way Atlantic Monthly would misspell the word special in a letter.
Again, this was very smart for its time. I mean...
It was very ahead of its time, absolutely.
And now, Mike, you've been waiting for this episode.
Oh, no, this is a Greg thing. Greg, you've been waiting for this episode.
Yeah, Episode 7, Dad and Me. When burglars clean out the Burton's apartment, Matt and Norman are forced into an unlikely partnership, posing as a father and son on a television game show with the hope of winning furniture. So what happened was Matt and Norman discovered in the newspaper that a game show called Dad and Me is looking for contestants. So Matt convinces Norman to write the show a sob story to get them on the air. So Norman is successful in getting them accepted as contestants, but also has some fun with Matt in the bio that he created by changing his name to Seymour Lamb and giving him the habit of dozing off at times due to being bitten by a testy fly. The two study each other's bios at length in preparation. On the show, Matt and quote-unquote Seymour are faced with nearly clone father and son team Bill and Bill Jr. Williams, who are almost unbeatable. To remedy this, Matt disconnects their buzzer so that they cannot answer a crucial question. Matt and Norman win and get to spin the bonus wheel for valuable prizes. They win a stereo and the new furniture that they had hoped for. But when the prize at stake is a telescope with a built-in camera that Matt has been saving up for, Norman purposely blows the answer. The next prize to be offered is a brand new car for Norman, who begs Matt to win it for him, even though he had ruined Matt's chance for winning the telescope. Matt agrees to win the car for him, with a wink to the audience. When he goes to answer the question, he lets out a neighing and falls asleep, the victim of the fictional testy fly bite. Norman is infuriated and begins to strangle Matt on the floor of the studio. Back at home, Matt returns from school, only to find his apartment stocked with their original furniture. Norman admits that he did, in fact, hire the burglars in order to force Matt to admit that he needed his help. And Norman concedes that he needed Matt's help as well in order to fill his apartment with the new prize furniture.
Wow.
This really does reek of, like, Married with Children type of stuff, like 88, 89-ish. This is, like, 4 or 5 years ahead of its time.
All I could say is they really did check each other. I think Norman might have gotten the upper hand on that one, though.
Yeah, he deprived Matt of that telescope with a camera. That would have been really cool back in 84.
Yeah, especially if you're a 14-year-old. But that car, though.
Episode 8, The Rival. Matt is determined to break up his mother's and Norman's relationship and hits on a scheme guaranteed to drive Norman into a jealous rage, a trait his mother despises in men.
Did we mention that a handsome actor was involved? Because that's important.
Wait, there's actors in Southern California that could be hired by a 14-year-old?
Yeah, it's Matthew freaking Burton. He could get anything. And besides, there's handsome actors in Southern California are a dime a dozen. They're all at Harvest Balls.
Oh, jeez. I'm sorry, I found that funny.
Oh, so did I. That's why I said. Episode number 9, Top Dog. Matthew finds he has created a monster when his scheme to prevent Norman from replacing his retiring teacher goes horribly wrong. So, yeah, his teacher disappears, and he hires a fake replacement so Norman will be out of a job.
So, in the episode, Norman poses as Inspector Smokey Bates' quote-unquote private eye for the public schools, and he confronts the substitute teacher about her misdeeds, and she attempts to bribe him, but he eventually convinces her to walk away from the teaching gig. In the end, Matt and Norman congratulate each other, and Matt heads out with a TV that the class had just given their teacher. He confesses that it was actually Norman's TV anyway.
I want to know where this school is, because I've never gotten anything near a TV. Usually I get ugly looks and vulgarities from my students. Where's this TV? I want to go to there.
We would have been lucky if we even had a decent TV in my school. And this is like 1984, where we still have two TVs.
I know. One for the bedroom and one for the living room. And if you had one for the bedroom, it was usually smaller than the one in the living room.
Because everything's smaller in the bedroom compared to elsewhere.
Phrasing?
No, that's out the window.
Well, next episode, number 10, Don't Leave Home Without It. As you could probably guess, a credit card is involved. In fact, it's Norman's new credit card, and it means two things. A romantic weekend alone with Eileen, and freedom from Matt's economic clutches.
Yeah, but there's a little catch.
What's the catch?
Well, what do you think Matt might do with a credit card?
Cancel it?
Matt cancels Norman's new credit card right before Norman leaves for a secret vacation with Matt's mother.
Oh, speed down.
You knew he was either going to max it out or he was going to cancel it. And Chico, you got the right one.
What do I get?
A canceled credit card.
Yay!
And then we hit the holidays. It's December 19th of 1984, and we get episode 11, The Christmas Show. The Burton family is poised to celebrate their Christmas in their traditional fashion, complete with Christmas Day bowling, guacamole, and picking up the San Diego Channel on their aluminum Christmas tree. Oh, that also gives you an idea of the date, because it's all rabbit ears back in 84, just about.
And that is about as big of a rabbit ears as I think I can imagine.
Norman, however, has more traditional plans that include thick, gooey eggnog and making his own Christmas presents. Plans go awry when traditions clash. Matt saves the day and still successfully makes Norman look like a fool.
Aww. It's an It's Your Move Christmas.
Yeah. There's a poem that Norman writes in the episode, and then Matt, I believe, switches the poem that's presented as Norman's. So I'm going to read the regular poem Norman has.
Okay.
This is the time for giving, and the time is the gift I give. Time to praise your gentle spirit, time to note your giving heart, time to thank your love and laughter, and for making me a part of your world of joyous living and your treasured measured time. And here's Matt's card presented as Norman's. Dear Eileen, thank you for helping me understand the true meaning of Christmas. It doesn't matter what your traditions are, as long as you're with the people you love. I'm sorry I was such a fool, an idiot, a jerk, a membrane. Please find it in your heart to forgive me. Love, Norman.
Ah. It hits me right there.
It does, but also another thing I noticed, it's called The Christmas Show. The genericish title sort of falls in line with other Christmas shows that Ron Levitt and Michael Moy did with Married with Children. And actually, I think one of their Christmas shows was actually called The Christmas Show.
Yeah, now that I think about
it. Just a casual observation. Now, Greg, take us to the next episode.
Oh, boy.
Buckle up.
Here we go.
Here we go. The greatest two-parter and the two-parter that everyone remembers about this show, The Dregs of Humanity, Parts 1 and 2. Part 1. Julie is panic-stricken that Matt is the treasurer of the school's entertainment committee and has $500 of the school's money to hire a band for the next dance. Matt is planning on hiring a new act called Morning Breath and then becomes panicked himself when he finds out that Eli has lost the money. Matt and Eli attempt to hire another act with their last $20, but find none of them to be acceptable. Matt then gets the idea to steal the skeletons from the school's biology lab, put capes on them, borrow music from a local band, and then pass them off as a live act.
Ladies and gentlemen, I give you The Dregs of Humanity!
See you.
The show comes off remarkably well, with everyone in town talking about this new band, who Matt has dubbed the Dregs of Humanity. In fact, Norman also gets the assignment from Music Press Magazine to interview this up-and-coming act. Matt decides to let them do a quote-unquote and puts a speaker on one of the skeletons, keeping them under the spooky lighting, and lets Eli answer Norman's questions. The article is also a success, and soon Matt gets offers for additional appearances, with each offer more lucrative than the last. The final offer is for the Dregs to play at the Palladium for $20,000. Matt and Eli decide to go for it.
Fun fact, the names of the Dregs of Humanity: on bass, Wolfgang; on the drums, Bones; on the keyboards, Graves; and the lead singer and talker of the group, voiced by Eli, Tombstone.
You know what this reminds me of? And again, this this postdates this episode of It's Your Move by maybe a year or two. Are you going to say it, Chico?
It's like, please don't say the Grateful Dead Touch of Grey video.
Yes, the Grateful Dead Touch of Grey video.
Because that it reminds me of the same thing, yeah.
Yes, this reminds me exactly of that.
So you think the Grateful Dead got the idea for the Touch of Grey video from It's Your Move?
Well, think about it. What did that video do for the Grateful Dead? That was huge.
I believe it was also their only number one hit ever.
At the very least, it was their first number one hit. I know that much, but I think you're right. It was their only number one hit. So you know what? That just proves the Dregs of Humanity is freaking amazing.
Oh, yeah. I download all the MP3s, man.
And he'd do it legally, too. That's how much he likes them. He'll actually pay the 99 cents per song.
It's $1.29 now. Where are you looking?
I'm not using inflation calculator.
But there's more to the story.
There's more?
There's so much more. See, Matt and Eli, they're planning to take the Palladium up on their 20,000, just like Greg said. And then rather than trying to utilize the skeletons again, the boys plan to hire some bums to wear their capes, and when the band is booed off stage, simply retire the act and keep the money. Now, Norman just bought a used car with the money from his music press interview with the band. Because if you remember, he didn't win that car on Dad and Me. And he also has a lucrative offer from Rolling Stone to do a follow-up interview with the Dregs. Matt stalls him, telling him he will run it by the band. Meanwhile, Eli has hidden the band's capes behind the curtains in Matt's room. Seemingly every team in town now congregates outside the Burtons' apartment in hopes of meeting the band members. Matt appeases Mr. Donatelli, who is concerned about crowds, by selling him a share of the band. Various people then begin to show up at Matt's apartment with lawsuits against the band amounting to $28.5 million, with ridiculous claims, including one girl who asserts that one of the band's members is the father of their newborn child.
Where's Maury Povich when you need him?
That's another show. Boy,
talk about a boner. They're skeletons. They're bones.
Okay. Yeah. I get it. Okay, so when Norman reveals that he now knows the truth about the Dregs, Matt begs him to help with the lawsuits. When Norman is reluctant to assist, Matt reminds him that he has written a published article about the band. Norman makes Matt sweat it out for a while, and then decides to help him out of the mess by assisting in killing off the Dregs. You would never get away with this in 2020, ladies and gentlemen. Matt suggests they kill him in a car accident. Norman just bought a car. They're going to use his car to push them in a body of water and literally have them drown. And the crazy thing is, this thing works. Julie is heartbroken about the Dregs. Rolling Stone still wants the article on the band, since they had been the only one to interview him. He decides not to cash in on the boys' misfortunes. Norman sees that Matt has other plans, as Norman is watching, because this is a popular thing at the time, Nina Blackwood's rockumentary on MTV. Matthew's being interviewed about his forthcoming book, The Dregs of Humanity, They Made Us Believe 'Em. And all of this, again, this would be perhaps the chef's kiss of two-parters, except for one small thing.
Yeah, the second part of this episode was preempted on the East Coast by a speech by Ronald Reagan.
Ooh.
Yeah, you'd have to wait till USA Network aired the reruns in order to find some sort of resolution.
No, I don't think so, because this did rerun up until summer of 85, so maybe at some point the second episode did air.
Ah, okay.
It just didn't air in its original spot. But even better, in a later episode of It's Your Move, it's revealed that the Dregs of Humanity, they were posthumously inducted into the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame.
How? On second thought, I don't want to know.
Well, considering that your acts have to be around 25 years, well, they're skeletons, so they could have easily been around 25 years.
They could have been around 50 years for all we know.
Exactly. Now I feel like I should go down I-90 about 15 miles from here, go to the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame, and say, damn it, where's the exhibits of the Dregs of Humanity? And they can be like, huh? What? What are you talking about? I saw this on It's Your Move back in 1985. They're in the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame. Where's my Dregs of Humanity?
Well,
that would actually be a good exhibit for the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame, like fake rock bands that have been on TV shows.
Oh yeah,
kind of sort of like Spinal Tap, but TV versions. Nina Blackwood, when asked about the whole Dregs of Humanity experience, she said, and I quote, "This is hysterical. You probably remember the episode better than I do. I thought Jason Bateman was delightful and talented. Who would have thought that he'd become such a huge star? He was a good young actor, yes, but he has really made a great reputation for himself." So she saw something in Jason Bateman, but she remembers absolutely nothing about this episode. And it's one of those episodes that's really gone down in cult TV history. So we're up to episode 14, Caught in the Act. But we have a little change here because NBC got letters. They got letters. They got letters. They got letters. Letters! But they're not good letters. Chico?
They're bad letters. They're letters basically saying, hey, NBC, need to stop your crap. My kid's doing all the stuff that Matthew Burton's doing, and now he's getting in trouble for it. You cut that mess out.
You know, that's a double-edged sword if you think about it. On one hand, yeah, the kids are doing bad stuff, but on the other hand, it sounds like people are watching the TV show.
Yeah, it does sound like people are watching the TV show.
So, Caught in the Act, episode 14, Eileen's image of her perfect son is permanently shattered after his scheme to get her a well-deserved pay raise backfires.
Whoops.
I don't know about you. I've never went to either of my parents' employers when I was 14 or any age and said, give my mommy or daddy a raise.
Well, and another thing is, how does Matt get the idea to do this? Norman.
Of course.
So for all we know, this could be Norman saying, this is how I win.
Well, not just this is how I win, but I'm going to do the evil scheming now, Matt, because apparently you're being a bad role model to kids across the country who are doing these things in school.
Mm-hmm. And when she asks Norman to talk to him about, he gloats, but she hears him, and he ends up in the doghouse. So that's the end of the Matthew Burton teenage schemer subplot. Can we call it a subplot if that's actually the driving force of the entire series?
It counts.
Okay. Okay, moving right along. Episode 15, Eli's Song. When a reluctant Norman is appointed coach of the high school's losing soccer team, Matt persuades him to give Eli the opportunity of a lifetime and make him second-string goalie. A pastiche of Rudy ensues.
But the one thing you can clearly tell is missing here is you don't see the word scheming anywhere. Now we've gone to more of a tame, pale sitcom.
Persuasion. Seduction, if you will. You know what I'm saying? It's gone from outright scheming to a more of a sly seduction, a persuasion. I believe Jay Heinrichs wrote about that.
It's gone from a glorious rocky road or chocolate chip cookie dough ice cream, and now it's just plain old vanilla.
Yeah, Rocky Road's another show, Mike.
Oh, good call. Good call.
Mm-hmm. Episode number 16, A Woman is Just a Woman. When an old boyfriend of Eileen's, who's rich among other things, returns, her children are happy at the prospect, but Norman feels he's going to lose her cause he doesn't have what her ex has. But to everyone's surprise, she chooses Norman. A while later, they learn that her ex found another girl and married her in a lavish wedding, and Norman still feels inadequate. This is like the callback episode, because Norman's has this sort of inadequacy sort of fix. But anyway, when an ex shows up, Norman decides to show Eileen how much he cares about her by rebuffing an ex in front of her, but Matthew, upon learning of the plan, decides to make a little alteration that shocks Norman too. So Matthew's not exactly done with the whole wink, wink, nod, nod. I'm not allowed to say, but you know what I'm saying.
It's just toned down a little bit.
Just a bit, yeah.
It's not happening in school. I think that might be the best way of saying toned down. Yeah. We're not gonna sabotage school, but we'll sabotage potential marriages, because marriages don't last forever.
Nope.
Mm-mm.
Second to last episode, The Experts. Acting on Matt's financial advice, Norman and Dwight make a killing in the stock market. Rather than dining out with their newfound wealth, they soon find themselves singing for their supper.
Whoops.
Yeah, and another thing I want to mention, the character Dwight was played by Garrett Morris of SNL fame. He was also the principal on the show of Matthew's school.
So Dwight is the principal?
Yes.
Okay.
So I'm guessing they had to keep him around in some way after they shifted the focus from school antics to
antics,
normal life antics.
Yes.
Yeah, and the big thing in this story is, just like the stock market, people get a little cocky and they lose everything. Well, as Jim Cramer would say, bulls make money, bears make money, but pigs, they get slaughtered. Oink, oink.
Sell, 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 sell.
Bye, bye, bye. Greg, take us home. Goodbye, farewell, and amen.
Yes. This is the story of Julie Burton, a cheerleader. Strangely enough, she's a cheerleader without cheer. A perverse crime is about to strike Julie down, a crime committed by the hands of one she trusted.
Boy, I wonder who that could have been. Oh, you know, I actually thought it was Matt, but looking at another recap of the show, classic whodunit where someone sabotages Julie at the school's yearly cheerleading auditions, Matt and Eli play detective.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, I thought that Matt and Eli might be the ones who were doing the scheming. They play detectives as they test theories, interrogating Julie's so-called friends and rivals. Now, it's kind of sad. Now, the show had already been canceled at this point, obviously, but it's sort of sad to see that this is the closure. The name of the episode is Goodbye, Farewell, and Amen.
And I believe the last shot of the show is a parody of Alfred Hitchcock Presents with Eli in the silhouette, like Alfred Hitchcock. Then he turns into the camera and says, thank you and good night.
That's great. That's great. Since It's Your Move originally aired, it did air in reruns on cable for a little while. But the one thing that we've all noticed that's missing is it's not on DVD or it's not available on any streaming sites. Come on! This show, and I think Greg and Chico will agree after seeing a handful of episodes in preparation for the show, this show needs to be somewhere. It may be short-lived, but it is really a great show. It is hilarious.
Yeah, put it, you know what? I believe it's owned by Sony. Why not Crackle?
Well, Married with Children is on Crackle, so that would be a perfect fit. And again, if you watch the two shows, not necessarily side by side, but you can see that Matt Burton is sort of like a rough draft of what might end up being Bud Bundy, even though he wasn't a schemer. He was just the smart one in the family, or the smarter one in the family, if you will.
Yes. Mm-hmm. But, I mean, come on. Shout Factory, give us a complete series DVD of this.
I'd pay $30 for it right now.
Yeah, it's become a bit of an underground cult favorite after getting absolutely slaughtered in the ratings, because guess what it was on against?
Oh, it's 1984, so it has to be something
Dynasty.
Like Dynasty. Dynasty, yeah. Oh,
yeah. Yeah, and the fact that it got letters didn't help either.
No.
You know, also, I think it really didn't help that the second half of the Dregs of Humanity episode didn't originally air on the East Coast. Reading the reviews about it, or the blurbs about it, it sounds absolutely brilliant and absolutely hilarious, and at least half the country didn't have a chance to see it, which is a shame. I mean, people may have been watching Dynasty instead, but still, just reading this is absolutely brilliant.
Absolutely brilliant, yeah.
I really want to see this.
Well, NBC ended up canceling this in 1985 for future entry, Double Trouble.
I don't even know what that is.
It was no It's Your Move.
Exactly. But guys, recently, the Dregs of Humanity episode of It's Your Move got a lot of attention when, for the 35th anniversary of the episode, Yahoo Music recently posted an article about the Dregs of Humanity. Even though this show didn't last long, Jason Bateman was going to turn out to be okay, because the following year, in 1986, he would be on a little family sitcom that would go through a bunch of names, but we know it best as the Hogan Family.
Yep.
Or Valerie.
Or Valerie's Family.
Yeah, any of the above are completely acceptable.
And of course, Jason Bateman, after the Hogan Family, would be in a bunch of future installments like Chicago Sons and George and Leo, eventually, until he found the right show in the 2000s with Arrested Development.
And we were all the better off for it.
And the rest is history.
Mm-hmm. The rest may be history, and we may have the prototype for scheming teenagers, but thanks to, a number of reasons, really. It's Your Move. In 1984, it's just a thing on TV.
Well, folks, that was It's Your Move, and Lord willing, I'm hoping one day Shout Factory, Milk Creek, Please get on it. We need It's Your Move, the complete series on DVD ASAP, especially in these times. But in these times, you have all the great stuff that's going on Place to Be Nation right now. And right here on the Place to Be Nation Pop Feed, on the latest episode of the Brother Sister Rewatch Podcast, Kevin and Mary looked at episodes 17 and 18 of The Office's fifth season, Lecture Circuit Part 2, and Blood Drive. Siblings sit down this week and discuss tons of topics from the shows, including Michael's meltdown in Nashua, or the Dwight Jim PPC team, Angel's uncovered eccentricity, a memorable lunch date, and Michael's unwavering optimism to find love. On the second episode of Pop Goes the Classics, Andy Atherton, Miranda Berfold, and Chad Campbell look at 1940s Pinocchio. They discuss many aspects of the film, including the animation style, especially the underwater scenes, the context of some of the parts of the film in regards to the time it was released, the introduction of Jiminy Cricket, the songs and music score, the scary horror aspects of it, the emotional high points, the many villains of the film, Honest John, Stromboli, the Coachman, and Monstro, the theme park attractions based on it, and the movie's lasting legacy. Also, be sure to check out the PTBN Wrestling Feed, which includes a dive into topics running the gamut from the days WWE through yesteryear. The feed includes the Place to Be Podcast main event, Jenny and the Gems, Body Pressure Lock, PTB, NXT, and so much more. Subscribe today. And while you're at it, subscribe to Jennifer Smith's The Jenny Position Feed as well, as is the new home of Deacon Sassy Talk Pop, Breakout Driving, Telling Stories, and more. Also, check out the new North-South Connection, brought to you by JT Rosero and Chad Campbell. It's the new home for Wrestling Warzone, No Looks Barred, the Extreme Three-Way Dance, Jeff Learns Wrestling, and more. In our social media pages, the greatest sports logo of 2020 tournament is going on. There'll be four matchups per day, so make sure to like our tournament page on Facebook or follow us on Twitter so you won't miss a single one. And don't forget our 2020 stretch project determining the greatest WCW match ever is going on. You have all year to do research, promote matches, and build your list because, well, you aren't doing anything else anytime soon, obviously. Conversation and rules can be found at www.facebook.com/GWCW matches or on the Pro Wrestling Always message board. Be sure not to forget to check out PlaceToBeNation.com each and every day. We have new voices and fresh takes, bring you articles on topics in the worlds of wrestling, sports, and pop culture, including Trent SmackDown on Fox Report, This Week in the WWE by John Crow, Paulie's Perspective, Jason's DVD Deep Dive, Ben's Unpopular Opinion, and don't forget about veteran columns like Glenn Butler's Wednesday Walk Around the Web. And if you're doing online shopping over at Amazon.com, be sure to click on the Amazon banner on the right side of the PTBN homepage or use www.placetobenation.com/Amazon. It takes you right to Amazon and helps out PTBN at no cost to you. All right, let's get into our final topic of the day as me, Mike, and Chico discuss the 1970s and 1980s Canadian game show, The Mad Dash. And this is a show that you have to see to believe. All right, here we go.
Episode 35, Submission 914, The Mad Dash. The Mad Dash aired on CTV from 1978 to 1985. Exact number of episodes, unknown.
In just a few moments, two lucky couples will start on the road to thousands of dollars in cash and prizes on The Mad Dash!
Folks.
So what do you get when you put the set of Classic Concentration smack dab in the middle of a board game? You get the Mad Dash. Oh yeah, and there's also a dice pit, because dice are involved, because it's a board game. Isn't that right, Greg?
Oh yes. You can't have a board game without dice. That's what I would say.
What about the Game of Life?
Well, yeah, you have the spinner. Oh, yeah. You have the spinner.
Yeah. Yeah, Candyland's got questions too while we're at it. And sorry. Yeah.
Sorry on line one.
But I mean, come on, the spinner in life, that would always break on you.
By the way, future installment.
Oh, yeah, that's right. I forgot there was a Life game show.
But we're not talking about that. We're talking about this, hosted by basically one of Canada's great game show treasures. Unfortunately, no longer with us, a man by the name of Pierre Lalonde. Justin, we were introduced to this by way of Canada's game show, the search for Canada's game shows, which is just an incredible documentary that is being aired by Game TV. And if you're like us, living in stateside, you can catch it at canadasgameshows.com and on the YouTubes. So,
and also our good friend Adam Neediff is interviewed in that series.
Yes, he is.
Yes, friend of the site, or friend of the podcast.
So, the Mad Dash, then. You have two pairs of contestants ready to dash through an oversized game board. Now, you would think that this would be some really, really big game board. Not really. It's actually quite small. There's only, not counting the start and win squares, which we will talk about momentarily, there's 20 spaces, not counting the start and win spaces. And each of the spaces has a chance to change the game radically. But we'll get to the board in a moment. Here's how the game works. You have two pairs of players. One member of each team is the designated roller who answered questions and remains with Pierre. The other is the dasher who becomes the life-size token on the game board. The board is a single winding path of 20 spots segmented into yellow, red, blue, and green spaces, which were marked to indicate the effect of landing on that space. The dashers begin at the start space, and the goal is to reach the win space. And of course, the first dasher to reach the win space wins everything they won during the dash. You're probably wondering, how are they going to move around the board?
How are they going to move around the board?
I'm glad you asked that. The roller has to win a multiple choice buzz-in jump-in question. And the first one to do so was given one roll of the die. The die had, it was your standard die from 1 to 5, but where the 6 is actually a dollar sign. The dollar sign adds $10 to the team's bank anytime it was rolled, and allowed for another roll. If you rolled the dollar sign 3 times in a row, it turns into a $50 bonus.
And I do believe that has happened on one of the episodes that's out there. There's not a lot of episodes, but I'm pretty sure that one of the episodes that exists did have somebody roll the dollar sign 3 times and get a total of $70.
Yes. Now, the object of the game, obviously, is to get to the win square. And if you get to the win square, you win everything you've won during the dash. If you won 7 matches in a row, you win the Lucky 7 jackpot, which is an accruing jackpot that includes $250 in cash and additional prizes with a total of $2,500 Canadian dollars. If you won 10 in a row later in the run, you retired as an undefeated champion. Now, this is a very wacky board, aside from being shaped like an oddly elongated question mark. The red spaces had a negative effect, like moving backwards, losing cash, losing prizes. The yellow spaces were everything else, directional spaces, whatever, what have you. Green spaces banked money, and blue spaces banked prizes. Now, if they land on a prize that they had already banked, they get an additional roll. Now here are the spaces that are usually on the board in the Mad Dash. Roll forward. Roller rolls the dice for the dasher to move forward. Roll back. Roller rolls the dice for the dasher to move back. Roll over. The roller would roll the die for the opposing dasher to move forward. Change places. The two dashers would switch places. The dasher who moved from change places was deemed to have landed on their new space and would take its effect. The free roll, the team would get a free roll. Missed turn. The opposing team gets a free roll. Back to start. Duh. Insurance. A team would get an insurance policy which protected them from any danger of losing either money or prizes. Go broke. The team lost all their banked cash, but the prizes stayed in play. If you had, now there are some episodes out there where if you had the insurance policy and you land on the space, you would put it down on the table and you would keep all the money. Return prizes. The team lost all their banked prizes but kept the money. Dash. A true or false question was asked to the dasher. The roller would roll the die with the dasher moving forward if they gave a correct answer, and backward if they did not. Breakaway. The roller would roll the die. The dasher would given that many seconds from 1 to 5 to run freely along the board toward the win space, stopping wherever they were when the time ran out. And of course, whatever you stop on, that effect takes place. Dice game. The player at the table would roll with 2 dice. If it resulted in $2 simples, the team would get $100 and another chance to roll. In addition, the player on the game board path moved the total number shown on the dice. Card game. The roller would draw from a standard deck of playing cards, and the dasher would move toward the number of spaces drawn, with ace being 1, unless a face card was drawn, in which case the roller had to roll the die, causing the dasher to move backwards. Happy birthday! The dasher would spin 2 wheels. One wheel had 5 money amounts raising from $25 to $200 and an insurance policy. The other had all the months of the year. The team would win the money spun. If the second wheel stopped on the player's birth month, the money was doubled. If the first wheel landed on the insurance policy, they would receive a policy which could prevent them from losing cash or prizes later. Pot of gold. A series of prizes that were instantly won, not banked, win or lose, no matter the outcome of the game. After the space was landed on, it was replaced by another prize. Thin ice. A true or false question was asked to the dasher. If they gave a correct answer, they could take a prize from their opponent's bank. If they did not, the opposing team could take one of their banked prizes. If a correct answer was given, but the opponent had no prizes, the team was given the chance to move forward up to 5 squares, paying $10 a square. And then there's a mini game. Now, there were many mini games, the most popular including Shooting Star, Beanbag, and the Mad Darts, all of which had some effects on the game. Brains or Brawn? The dasher would choose to take either Brains, a question, or Brawn, a physical stunt. If they were successful, the roller would roll the die and the dasher would move forward. If they were unsuccessful, it meant the dasher had to go back. And interesting way to win the game. The only way you can win the game was to roll the exact number that you needed to win the game. It was sort of like Jumanji, almost. In fact, this is probably the game show version of Jumanji.
I'm going to add one thing about the Shooting Star, which really made the game very important when it showed up on the show. One of the items on the Shooting Star, which all you had to do was there was a star, a wooden star, if you will, a giant wooden star, and there were Velcro spots on the on this star relating to different actions, activities, prizes, and the dasher got to throw up to 3 Velcro balls at this game board, and whatever prize they hit or whatever section they landed on, they got that prize or that penalty or that bonus. But the big bonus that showed up on the Shooting Star, which was highly coveted, is there's a space that is called the lose-loss. And what that means is that if a team has lost a game, that loss is removed, giving the team a further chance to stay on if they lose. Because in the Mad Dash, if you lost 2 games, you're retired. Uh-huh. So this would be very crucial, especially if you saw this in an episode where, say, the champs had 6 wins, and if they win this game, they're going to get the prize jamboree or whatever. And if they had 1 loss, yeah, if they lose that game, they're gone. They wouldn't get the prizes. That lose-loss would be extremely significant. And every time I've seen the Shooting Star played, I think I've seen every team go for the lose-loss because it means that much, because that's like the ultimate insurance policy. Forget the insurance policy for not taking away the cash and prizes. This keeps you on the show.
Yep.
Yes.
Related to what Chico mentioned about having to win on an exact roll, if you roll too much, you go back the game on the game board, the number of spaces extra you would have gone. And usually that ends up in one of two things. One is one of the spaces is lose all your money. That's usually the space right immediately before the win. But also at the same time, the space immediately before lose all your money is usually big money, like $100 or $50, or I think I've even seen $150. So you can make a lot of money right there at the end or lose a lot of money right there at the end, depending on your luck of the roll. But also, when we're talking about Canadian game shows, especially in this era, when we talk about prizes, we're not talking about fur coats and furniture sets and a kitchen of appliances. Oh, no. What we're talking about is a movie for two. We're talking about dinner for two to your favorite restaurant or to the original spaghetti warehouse or a hotel for a night for two or smaller appliances, a typewriter. Not budget-breaking prizes at all. So the thing is, when you're talking about a team that may have been on for six or seven matches, if they didn't win that that bonus jackpot, they may have only accumulated at that point maybe $2,000 worth of prizes in cash, maybe even less than that. So by no means were people making a ton of money on this show. This isn't like the game shows in America where – yeah, $5,000 or $10,000 every day would be a commonplace bonus amount. No. Very small bucks.
So, Mike, you might want to say the budget on this show was cheap, cheap, cheap.
I'm going to steal a line from Chico. Greg, go to your room. Think about what you did and just how badly you did it. And then come back in about 20 minutes after you've done repenting.
Oh.
But if you watch an episode of this show, I mean, the Mad Dash, that title just does not do it proper justice. It is crazy. It is absolutely crazy. It is bonkers.
And also, it really is sort of on the cheap, not just because of the prizes, but again, it's basically the elongated question mark game board that Chico mentioned earlier, and you have the other contestants and Pierre Lalonde, the host, standing at basically a podium with two not very expensive buzzers on either side for the contestants, and it slants downward the dice pit. So it can't roll off the table. It'll roll down, and there's a nice view of the die once it gets into that dice pit. Not terribly extravagant, but also at the same time, it's really fun. I mean, it may be a little on the cheap, yes, but this is really a fun game, and I think that's what really got Greg interested in this show.
Yeah, the cheapness of this show is what makes the charm of this show great.
It really does. And the thing is, I don't know if they interviewed the teams beforehand. Presumably they did, but all of the teams came from the studio audience. So they didn't necessarily go through the audition process. Oh, hey, you know, we're choosing you. Come down to Montreal to tape these shows. No. All the pairs were taken directly from the audience, which is also a throwback to older days when you'd get picked from the audience to be on a TV show. But also, there were times when the show didn't end promptly on time, so you had a mini-dash every now and then. And what the mini-dash was you had one or actually sometimes a couple of audience members called down. What they do is they play for a prize, and they choose one of five different envelopes. Each of the envelopes has three questions. You only need to get two of the three correct to win the prize. Also, on some of the episodes, there's an instant win and an instant loss in two of the five envelopes, which seems kind of mean. You get the instant loss. You just come down, hey, it's my time to be on CTV. I'm going to play for a toaster or a crock pot. Okay, I'll take this envelope. You open it up, instant loss. Bye. Have a nice day. That's sort of... But also, annoying. It does actually go in well with the show because that's all based on luck. It's all how lucky are you with the dice, how lucky are you with getting in fast enough to answer the questions. So it's actually a fair trade-off, I think. It's an apt comparison or an apt audience game.
Yeah.
Yep.
What a show this was. Let me tell you. It was just, when I first saw this format, like on the Canada's Game Shows YouTube page, and I saw the pilot episode of the Med Dash, I'm like, what a concept. A human board with dice and questions, and it's like classic concentration style with prizes and everything. Oh,
I just remember
pure gold.
Yeah, all I can say is I remember back when it was called Video Village.
I was just going to say there was a show back in the 50s and 60s called Video Village, which was essentially the same type of TV show, the oversized board game. But this would be like the perfect show for GSN, I think. It wouldn't be terribly high stakes. It would be reasonably easy to set up. I mean, you don't need really too much electronics unless they really wanted to go that route. The only thing is, it really hasn't been on television for a long time. Not just even talking about the Canadian version. There was another version, and I remember getting an email from Sidney Cohen, who created the show. He actually emailed me maybe about 20 years ago, and that was my initial introduction to the Mad Dash. And at the time, he had actually sold a version to Poland, which aired on Polish television from 1998 to 2000. So,
that again, current,
you're talking about 20 years ago at this point.
Yeah, that current, huh?
Well, like I said, it's been a long time. It's been 35 years since the Canadian version aired, and it's been 20 years since the Polish version aired. So, yeah, I don't want to necessarily say it's due for a reboot, but again, this is such a fun format. I could definitely see some network on the cheap really just taking a chance on this. Plus also, again, talking with Mr. Cohen, again, 20 years ago or so, he really, well, obviously he wants to sell it because that would be more money for him, but he thinks it's just such a great format that everybody can enjoy. It's not terribly difficult. The questions aren't Jeopardy level by any means. So it's accessible to everybody in the family.
There you go.
Plus also the music. The music on this show now, admittedly, you know, 1978 to 85, you're getting older music, but really it is some great music in my opinion. Great music, great cues, great sound effects.
Just really good stuff. And interesting thing that I found out, this actually aired. Now, this is a Canadian show. This is a Canadian show for a Canadian audience. It was taped in Montreal for CTV. And if you got CTV on the Border Blaster stations up north, you got the Mad Dash.
And you see, I am in the up north, or at least close enough to get television from Windsor and London, Ontario back in the day. And I don't remember this. I remember, I believe it's Companion Show, which would have been Guess What? I don't think that's an entry, but maybe that's worthy of being an entry. I remember Guess What? I don't remember the Mad Dash, though. Maybe, again, maybe it was later in 85 or 86 I remember seeing it, but Regardless, yeah, we could definitely access it back in the day from here. Now, unfortunately, Greg mentioned the pilot made it online recently. Unfortunately, due to erasing episodes, there's probably only about maybe about a dozen episodes plus the pilot out there. So there's, again, not a big sample size to work with, but pretty much everything we talked about in terms of the different spaces and different actions and side games, those take part at least on one episode in the dozen or so existing episodes.
Well, the Mad Dash, it certainly was a wild show. You had a bunch, a board game with people on it moving spaces. You had contestants rolling dice. You had simple, fun trivia questions. The Mad Dash definitely was a thing on TV.
It was a mad thing on TV.
It was a fun thing on TV. You know what else is fun? Go into our website, www.itwasathingontv.com. You know what else is fun? Liking and subscribing to us, and also rating and reviewing us. We like being rated and reviewed on Apple Podcasts and other fine podcasting platforms.
You know what's even more fun than that? Sharing.
Sharing is caring, as you say. And also, in addition, what else is fun? There's 34 prior episodes you can go listen. Actually, 35 if you include the pilot, the episode zero that Greg and I did before Chico joined us.
Even more fun than that, our good friends at the Place to Be Nation Pop.
Yes.
Is that right, Greg?
Yes, every Wednesday, a trio of episodes from our back catalogs getting loaded up. And right now, we are up to, I believe, episode 20, because it was this past week that just aired, that just came up, was First Night 2013, Super Jeopardy! Monopoly, and the Millionaire Knockoff. So, getting close to getting up to date.
Yeah, they're only about a month and a half away. Well, until next week, we'll have two new episodes. One is an episode that I know at least one person has mentioned, oh, I can't wait for this episode. You need to be doing an episode about this. Well, we're doing an episode about this next week. And then the other episode, the later episode that week, it's not about a TV show. Let's say sort of like a concept. You know, we had the episode about the Tommy Westfall universe. It's not in that vein, but it's related to TV. And I know Greg's got some stuff he needs to get off his chest about that topic. You've got stuff to say about everything.
I got five words for you. Real men don't need instructions.
There's a big hit for our second episode. And our first episode, well, I can't think of a big hint for the first episode, except maybe go watch Grease or something.
Oh, no. The hint for that episode is it's bad. People have been asking, when are you going to cover this show? Even one person has said, can I be a guest on that show? And with reluctance, I had to say no. But yeah, so there's two great episodes next week. Oh, the second one is going to be real fun, I think. It'll be a very fun, interesting episode. That's coming up next week, starting March 2nd. Until then, again, thank you for listening. Keep on liking, subscribing, rating, reviewing, doing all the good stuff for us. We thank you for your support, and we will talk to you next time with yet another thing on TV. Bye-bye.
Wow! The Mad. Yeah!